Have you ever come across the concept of custom beauty? I know it sounds skeptical. It's like every time you scroll online, there's a new miracle product promising to fix your hair and skin woes. But let me tell you, PROS is the real deal when it comes to custom beauty. It's not just some marketing gimmick. Your personalized formula wouldn't even exist without your input. Each product on PROS is whipped up just for you, tailored to your specific needs, and they go deep into their consultations, delving into over 80 factors to really get a handle on your life and beauty goals. We're talking about everything from your hair and skin concerns to what you eat, how much you work out, and even how stressed you are. My friend Jen has been using PROS and raving about it non-stop. They even asked her about her zip code to suss out things like water hardness and UV index. When I hit the States later this year, PROS is going to be at the top of my shopping list. But until then, I'm living vicariously through Jen's luscious locks and glowing skin. Trust me, this stuff is the real deal. PROS is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at PROSE.com/morbidology. That is PROSE.com/morbidology for your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formula, PROSE.com/morbidology. Ever felt like life's rhythm doesn't quite sync with your payday schedule? Yeah, I get it. That's why there's Earnin, your ticket to getting your hard-earned cash when you need it, not just every couple of weeks. Imagine this, you're out with friends and suddenly they decide on an impromptu dinner. But oops, you haven't received your paycheck yet. Or maybe you realise you forgot to grab a last-minute gift for someone special. It's those little moments that can throw us off. Well, Earnin has got your back. With the Earnin app, you can access up to $100 a day or up to $750 per pay period, all before your official payday. It's simple. Just download the app, verify your paycheck, and boom, peace of mind is yours. Join over 3.5 million customers who've said goodbye to payday worries and hello to financial flexibility with Earnin. Download Earnin today. Spelled EARNIN in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Morbidology under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. Morbidology under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust. Member FDIC. Today's sponsor is Hidden Compass. It's an amazing, award-winning, woman-led media company that is turning storytellers and explorers into heroes and championing a new age of discovery. Hidden Compass have a digital magazine, podcast, and even a speaker series. And in November of this year, they're launching a modern exploration society, one that is global and inclusive. Just think of the National Geographic Society of 1888, but reimagined for 2021 and beyond. The stories on Hidden Compass nourish and challenge, and their aim is to inspire courage and curiosity. Just click the link in my show notes or head on over to hiddencompass.net for more. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In June of 2014, a woman in Calgary, Canada, went to her parents' home to pick up her young son, who'd been dropped off the night before for a sleepover. When she arrived, however, she found that the home was eerily silent, and in the driveway, she found drag marks and a sinister-looking red liquid. It was around 10 a.m. on Monday the 30th of June 2014, when police in Calgary, Canada, were called by a woman who said that she was scheduled to pick up her 5-year-old son from her parents' home. However, when she arrived at their home in the 100 block of 38A Avenue Southwest, neither her parents or her son were there. She said that evidence at the home suggested that something suspicious could have taken place. 5-year-old Nathan O'Brien had been dropped off by his mother, Jennifer O'Brien, at the home of her parents, 66-year-old Alvin Lickness and 53-year-old Catherine Faye Lickness. She had dropped Nathan off the day beforehand for a sleepover. You can see photographs of all three up on the Vodacast app. Nathan lived at home with his mother, Jennifer, and his father, Ron. He was the youngest of three boys. He was known to be a very friendly and polite little boy, and quite the chatterbox. He loved superheroes and hockey. He skated with the Timbits team and loved getting out on the rink and making new friends.
Nathan, how old are you today?
5.
Despite the fact that Nathan was only 5 years old, he had a massive heart and exuded compassion. His school had a monthly charity project, and Nathan would always get excited to make sandwiches for the homeless. Jennifer fondly recalled, "They'd have sandwich Fridays once a month, and we put together a loaf of sandwiches to help the homeless. And that's something he was excited about. He'd come home from school and we'd make them together, and he really liked that." Alvin and Catherine were in the process of moving home. They'd planned on moving to a new home in Edmonton to downsize, and then planned on moving on to Mexico. Missing person flyers were distributed throughout the area and posted online. They described Nathan as Caucasian, approximately 3 feet tall with blonde curly hair and brown eyes. He was last seen wearing peach-coloured shorts and a striped blue hoodie. Alvin was described as standing around 6 feet tall, weighing 200 pounds, with a slim build and greyish blonde hair. Catherine was described as standing at 5 feet 3 inches tall and weighing 120 pounds with reddish-brownish hair and green eyes. Almost straight away, an Amber Alert was issued for Nathan. As Calgary Police spokesman Kevin Brookwell stated, "She comes back at 10 this morning. Notably sees that the house is not normally as it is, and there's other things within the house that would lead us to believe that they did not leave on their own volition." He refused to elaborate on what these things specifically were, but he did announce that Alvin and Catherine were not suspects in their grandson's disappearance, and they were missing along with him. Provincial officials had decided to bend the rules a little bit when it came to declaring the Amber Alert. Typically, for an Amber Alert to be issued, there needs to be a vehicle description and a known abduction. However, evidence in the home suggested that Nathan, Alvin and Catherine had been taken against their will. Investigators, as well as the family, were baffled as to who could have abducted or harmed the family, or why. There were absolutely no custody issues within the family, and Nathan's parents were both happily married. All of the family's cars were accounted for, which led to speculation that somebody else must have been involved. Their first point of investigation was to speak with neighbours of Alvin and Catherine to see if anybody had seen or heard anything suspicious or out of the ordinary. According to one neighbour, they had seen Nathan playing in the back garden on the Sunday afternoon. Investigators cordoned off a wide area within the neighbourhood as they canvassed the area for any evidence and began to question neighbours. A helicopter hovered overhead as investigators searched through bins, drains, and areas between the homes. Just hours before Nathan had been dropped off at his grandparents, a real estate sale had taken place at Alvin and Catherine's home, with a steady stream of people entering and exiting the home. They had been planning on moving and had advertised much of their furniture on Kijiji. Their advertisement had read, "All house contents for sale, moving out of the country." Nathan and Jennifer had been at the home as the sale was going on to help out. While there, Nathan liked to remind his grandmother to say thank you when she sold something to one of the many people who were passing through the home. That night, Jennifer had left her parents' home at around 10 p.m, leaving Nathan there for a sleepover. Investigators announced that it was too early in the investigation to speculate that the real estate sale was somehow relevant to the disappearance, but they did ask anybody who may have been at the sale to come forward and get in contact with them for a routine interview. There was, of course, the possibility that the disappearance could have been related to a potential robbery gone wrong, so it was certainly a line of inquiry that investigators were looking into. As the investigation into the disappearance was underway, the community really bonded together to try and ensure that the trio were found unharmed, and Nathan returned to his parents. Nathan's parents would make an emotional plea for their son's safe return. His father, Rod, stated, "Everybody in Calgary and the surrounding area, please keep your eyes open." He thanked the community for all of their help this far and for rallying around the family and offering their support. Jennifer and Rod spoke about Nathan's love for superheroes. In fact, instead of wearing regular clothing, Nathan mostly dressed in superhero costumes. On television, they urged Nathan to be a superhero again.
Nathan? You are our superhero right now, and we're going to bring you home very soon. To whoever has Nathan, please find it in your heart to drop off our little angel, Nathan, to which he can be rescued and reunited with his brothers and his family.
Jennifer appealed to her son.
I'm Nathan's mother, Jennifer O'Brien, and I'm the daughter of Alvin and Kathy Lickness. I appreciate you guys being here because I need Nathan to hear our voices, and I'm grateful for you guys to allow this to happen. And Nathan, I need you to hear my voice right now, and I need you to know that Mommy and Daddy love you more than anything in this world. And we can't be with you right now, but the best people that can be with you other than us is your grandparents. And I know Grandma's holding you so tightly right now and taking care of you, and they are doing everything in their power to keep you safe. So I need you to know that. Stay strong, Nathan. Stay strong. We know you are our superhero, and I just need you to stay strong, and we are going to see you. We're going to see you, and we love you so much.
You can watch the entire press conference on the Vodacast app. It would soon enough be reported that the sinister evidence found at the home included signs that somebody or something had been dragged from the side door of the home to a driveway, leaving behind a trail of dark liquid. Despite the very sinister aspects of the crime scene, Homicide Unit Staff Sergeant Doug Andrus said, "Right now, we are very positive that we are going to find these individuals, and we are hoping that we are going to find them alive."
I would say it's less a mystery to us. I can't comment on the degree. Again, we're getting good information coming in, and we're going through it, and we're determining the relevance to the investigation. But we have moved forward with the investigation. We don't know if this is a random situation or not. Again, we're keeping an open mind and looking at all possibilities. We don't know the motive at this point. And that's one of the answers that we want to get during the course of our investigation. What was the motive of this?
Jennifer and Rod had wanted to put forward a reward fund for the safe return of their son and Jennifer's parents. However, Chief Rick Hansen said that in cases such as this one, sometimes reward could cause more work for investigators, because it meant that more people would step forward with phony tips that they would then waste their time checking out. In addition to speaking with neighbours of the Lickness family and those who had attended their real estate sale, investigators were also looking through CCTV footage from homes and businesses in the area to determine if any of them could have captured anything amiss which could assist in the investigation. Investigators had asked anybody who had purchased anything from the real estate sale to bring a photograph of the item they had purchased to the community centre and speak with investigators. The purpose was to determine what from the home had been sold and whether any items were missing from the home after the sale. Investigators wanted to determine whether anything had been stolen from the home, but since they had a pretty large sale that day, it was hard to make a determination. At the community centre, investigators had set up 6 tables that were manned by investigators with notepads in front of them, so that they could speak with all of the people who purchased an item. In the first few days of the investigation, around 100 tips came into investigators from across the nation, and 6 investigators had been assigned to follow up every single tip. A blog was also set up so that people could send in messages to the family, along with information about how to get in contact with Crime Stoppers. Investigators would soon enough reveal that evidence found inside the home indicated that some kind of violent incident had taken place. Staff Sergeant Andrus said that they had sent evidence away to be examined, and when those results came back, they hoped that they would have a better understanding. He said that evidence showed that somebody was very likely in medical distress. He also revealed that there was no evidence of a forced entry to the home, and that they were still no closer to a motivation than they were on day one. While Staff Sergeant Andrus wouldn't elaborate on what was found inside the home, he did say that they were looking for the driver of a pickup truck that was spotted several times in the area on the Sunday night, which was around the last time that Nathan, Alvin and Catherine were last seen by Jennifer, as she left at around 10 p.m. He said that CCTV footage in the area had captured the pickup truck, and it was late 80s or early 90s green Ford F-150, which looked to be in very good condition, almost as if it were new. He refused to call the driver of the pickup truck a suspect, but said he could have information about the missing trio. You can see the CCTV footage of that pickup truck on the Vodacast app. Just the following day, however, Sergeant Andrus announced that a violent encounter preceded the disappearance of Nathan, Alvin and Catherine, and that if they were survivors of the confrontation, then they would be in dire physical help. While he didn't state that there was blood found inside the home, it seemed apparent that that was the case based on what he was saying. By this point in the investigation, over 40 investigators were working on the case around the clock, but they still did not have a motivation. However, they did say that it could be related to the real estate sale. Investigators would turn their attention to a rural property in Airdrie. Locals within the area noticed the large police presence, which included RCMP resources. They were conducting a grid search of the property while a helicopter hovered overhead. They would confirm that the extensive search in the area was in relation to the disappearance of Nathan and his grandparents. Inspector Joel Matthews would announce that after releasing the information about the pickup truck, the tip had led them to the property in Airdrie. He revealed that the homeowner had been arrested without incident, but would not confirm whether he was somehow involved or whether he was a suspect in the disappearance. Right now, he was being interviewed by investigators while his home and grounds were being searched. Just hours after the man was arrested, however, he was released. According to investigators, the man remained a person of interest, and they were still in the process of searching his property. Where the man lived was on the outskirts of Airdrie, and it was a large plot of land, so it was expected that the search would take days. During the first day of the search, they had found a truck, which was similar to the one spotted on CCTV, but they were still trying to figure out whether the man was somehow involved in the disappearance, and whether he somehow knew the family. At one point during this search, they zeroed in on a pond near the property and called in canine units to assist as well as a boat. The man who owned the property would be identified as 54-year-old Douglas Garland, and it would be uncovered that he certainly did have a connection to the Lickness family. His sister was married to Alvin's son, Alan Lickness, from a previous marriage. Douglas also had an extensive history with law enforcement. Back in 1992, his parents' home, which was the home investigators were now searching, was raided in relation to drug production. He'd been making amphetamines. Douglas was arrested but released on bail, and while on bail, he fled to Vancouver, where he assumed the identity of a deceased teenage boy called Matthew Hartley. It wouldn't be until 1999 that he was finally tracked down in Vancouver and arrested. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 39 months in prison. He received an additional month for possession of stolen property. However, the Parole Board of Canada gave him accelerated release after just 6 months. They stated that a psychologist had determined that Douglas's mental health had played a role in the crimes that he had committed, but said that he had very little violence potential to others. You can see a photograph of Douglas on the Vodacast app. At one point in time, Douglas did have a promising future. He had attended medical school but left after suffering from a mental breakdown. He was also traumatised after being in a car accident after he fell asleep at the wheel and reportedly suffered from attention deficit disorder. According to court documents, at one point in time, Douglas had a successful job at a laboratory where he was hired to test pesticides, herbicides and organic compounds. He was even promoted to supervisor, but after working there for around 4 years, he suffered another mental breakdown and was fired from the role in 1997. He had taken this role while under the false identity. After Douglas served his sentence for the drug charges, the Canada Revenue Agency came after him for employment insurance benefits it had given him when he was fired from the laboratory job because he had been using a fake name as well as a fake social security number. Douglas would take the Canada Revenue Agency to court, and while acting as his own lawyer, he won the case in 2005. Justice Campbell Miller ruled that Douglas was extremely intelligent and performed his role in the lab well. She wrote, "While Mr. Garland assumed the name to avoid detection, he did not enter the employment agreement with any ill intention. He simply needed to work in a job for which he was qualified." Following Douglas's release, he would be arrested again. However, he was arrested in a completely unrelated matter and was charged with identity theft. Jennifer and Rod appeared in court for Douglas to be charged in relation to that matter. Outside of court, Rod was briefly asked by the media if he believed that there was a connection between his family and Douglas. He replied, "I do, but I'm not going to comment today." He also asked the community to continue keeping their eyes open. Just because there was a person of interest in the case, it didn't mean that it was solved. Nathan, Alvin and Catherine were still missing after all. Calgary Police spokesman Kevin Brookwell said that they were looking into whether there was a connection between a bad business deal and the disappearance of Nathan, Alvin and Catherine, but said that at this moment he could not elaborate any further. A police presence could be spotted at all three landfill sites in Calgary. Much of the public began to speculate that a tip or evidence had led them there, but a police spokesman would say that it was standard procedure to search landfills for evidence. He said that the search would continue until no stone is left unturned. As investigators were concentrating their efforts at Douglas's home, as well as local landfills, neighbours of Alvin and Catherine started a Green Ribbon campaign in the hopes that it would keep the home fires burning. Laurie Swinson, who had come up with the idea, said that around 600 ribbons had been made from 250 metres of green cloth. The green ribbons were adorned on the trees throughout the neighbourhood and were a symbol of hope that Nathan, Alvin and Catherine would return home safely, as well as a symbol of unity, that the community were there to support the family. Laurie said to the Calgary Sun, "I hope they feel some comfort knowing that they are not alone. There's a community standing with them." Just a couple of days after Douglas was arrested on the unrelated charges, the Crown agreed to his release. Prosecutor Shane Parker told the courtroom that before he could be released, they needed to iron out some conditions for his bail, such as where he was going to live. His current address, where he lived with his parents, was still being searched by investigators in relation to the disappearances. Meanwhile, a candlelight vigil was being held on the evening of the 10th of July. It had been 10 long days since the trio had disappeared. Family, friends and even strangers gathered in the community of Parkhill, just around the corner from the Lickness home. Jennifer, who was standing alongside her husband, stood before the crowd and said, "We are very hopeful that they are still out there. There's no doubt in our minds. We've just got to find them. She thanked the community for all of their support.
This is what's helping get us through as a family. It's your prayers. It's the kind messages that you're sending. It's the food that you're sending. It's coming over to our house and spending time with us. That's what keeps our family strong.
Alvin's son from a previous marriage, Jeff, said that he wasn't thinking of the candlelight vigil as a funeral, because it wasn't. While his brother Josh said that he was excited to see his parents and his nephew again, because he knew that one day that day would come. Investigators would announce after the candlelight vigil that they were currently looking into business dealings of Alvin as well as Douglas. There had been reports that Alvin had recently been forced to close his small gas exploration company, and there were also reports that he once had a bad business deal with Douglas. Alvin had been linked to several oil and gas companies, the most recent of which was a small firm called Winter Petroleum Limited. It had been forced to close just a few weeks earlier, after it had its equipment seized over $800,000 that was owed in taxes. In 1994, Alvin had filed for bankruptcy, and then in 2012, Catherine, who is a real estate agent turned website design consultant, did the same. As investigators were looking into this new angle, Douglas was released from jail on bond, along with strict conditions, and was ordered to live in transitional housing such as a hotel, motel, or even a homeless shelter. He was also ordered to report to his bail supervisor 3 times a week and to police 1 a week. He had a curfew from 9 p.m. until 7 a.m. every day, and he could not leave Alberta. He was also told he couldn't return to the home he had shared with his parents, which was currently being searched, and was to remain under the care and direction of a physician. With Douglas free on bail, investigators turned their attention once more to the home of Alvin and Catherine. They announced that they weren't looking for anything specific, but were just wanting to make sure that they hadn't missed anything the first time around. Just the following day, there was a crushing update in the case when investigators announced that they believed that Nathan, Alvin and Catherine were dead, but they had not yet found their bodies. They announced that they were calling off the Amber Alert and that the missing person investigation was transforming into a triple homicide investigation. They arrested Douglas once again and stated he was facing 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder.
It's been 2 weeks to the day of the disappearance of Nathan O'Brien and Catherine and Alvin Lickness. We have arrested a man in relation to what has been an extremely challenging and heart-wrenching investigation. At approximately 1:30 a.m. today, officers arrested a man in the Airdrie area. He is currently in custody and charges of 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder are pending until he has seen a justice of the peace. I'm prohibited from releasing his identity. The Amber Alert in relation to this file has been discontinued. However, the bodies of the 3 victims have not been found, and we continue to ask people to come forward with any information they may have. Most importantly, we ask rural property and business owners to please search their properties for anything suspicious. We know that this community has been anxious for answers to an investigation that has gripped this city for the last 2 weeks.
The following day, Douglas appeared in court to be formally charged. The charges didn't provide any kind of closure for the family. Not by a long shot, because the body still hadn't been found, meaning that no funerals could be held and no gravesite to mourn at. Alvin's son Jeff said that the decision to declare the case a triple murder was extremely difficult for the family to accept, adding that they were still hanging on to the tiny glimmer of hope that somehow the investigators were wrong. The community rallied around the family as a makeshift memorial started to build up outside the Lickness home. There were flowers, stuffed animals, balloons, and of course a Superman t-shirt, which read, "Forever loved, always remembered." That evening, green balloons were released into the sky to honour the 3 lives that were taken. Lori, who had organised the green ribbon, said that the community support was more important now than ever. The revelation that Nathan, Alvin and Catherine were deceased really hit the community hard. They truly bonded together to try and bring them home safely. Many dedicated many hours, searching for the trio and providing around-the-clock support. A book of condolences was also set up for people in the area to leave notes for the family of the trio. Chief Rickhanson announced that he didn't blame the family if they were still clinging to hope that their loved ones were still alive. However, he said that he had reviewed the forensic evidence which connected Douglas to the disappearance and said that there was absolutely no doubt that they were all, unfortunately, deceased. He said that it gave him no satisfaction to be sure that they were deceased, other than to know that when Douglas goes to trial, it will result in a conviction. He stated, "This is not a decision we come by easily, but when all of the evidence points to one thing, we would be remiss if we weren't totally honest, as painful as we know that is for the family and for the community." Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. With no bodies, it was of course going to be a very difficult case for the prosecution to prove. Bodies provide the bulk of the evidence in a murder case. But despite that, Senior Crown Attorney Shane Parker announced that he was confident that the evidence they did have thus far would be extremely compelling. Calgary Police would issue a statement thanking the searchers for their assistance in the case, but would state that they no longer needed their assistance. Volunteers had been searching the rural areas, near the community where Douglas had lived with his parents. Calgary Police themselves would be continuing the search for the bodies, and partnered with the National Research Council of Canada to use the federal government organization's equipment in their search. They also called in the assistance of Viewworks, who sent up a helicopter equipped with advanced technology that had the ability to detect small ground disturbances. On the 20th of July, they would announce that the search of Douglas's property was complete. Investigators were confident that the three bodies were not on the property. Their investigation would then shift to Mexico. They refused to elaborate on why their attention had shifted there, but did state that there were no other suspects or persons of interest. In September, Douglas appeared briefly in court where a preliminary hearing was scheduled for the 19th of May. Outside of court, his defence lawyer, Kim Ross, said that the 8-month wait isn't really a lengthy period in a case of this magnitude. He said that it was a very complex case and he expected there to be a long wait before they were ready for the preliminary hearing. Just a couple of days after the preliminary hearing was scheduled, hundreds of people packed into the First Lions Church to pay their respects to Alvin and Catherine. There had been a private memorial service for Nathan earlier that month. The couple's son, Jeffrey, spoke fondly of his parents. He described them as loving and nurturing, and became emotional as he said he never got to say goodbye to them. Alvin's daughter and Catherine's stepdaughter, Nancy Lickness, said that they all felt homesick and missed the loving home that the couple had provided for them. She said, "If you looked up the word trooper in the dictionary, you'd find Kathy's photo." All of Alvin and Catherine's children spoke about the warmth they felt for their parents, and spoke about how welcoming and loving they were, adding that their own children loved to go over to their grandparents' home, much like Nathan did. Jennifer, Nathan's mother, said that she still found herself gravitating to their home, hoping that she may find the trio there. Jerry Hodgins, who was one of Catherine's best friend, said that Catherine had fallen in love with Alvin the very second she laid her eyes on him. The couple had met as co-workers. Alvin was remembered as a humble and thoughtful man, who preferred life in the background. While people said that Catherine would have loved to see the turnout, Alvin would have been embarrassed by all of the attention. His nephew, Calvin Ellerby, said, "Alvin was a private guy. To hear all of these stories about him, he would have been bashful." He told the mourners not to grieve without hope, stating that hope changes everything. He said, "Memories allow us to look backwards, but hope makes us look forward. It gives us expectations." Towards the end of October, an anonymous donor donated $1 million over 4 years to implement the Nathan O'Brien Children's Foundation. Jennifer stated that they had wanted to set up the foundation to focus on children in need, providing funds to a charity chosen by friends and family yearly. The massive donation just showed what an impact the case had on the community. The family were over the moon with the generosity of the donor. Jennifer said, "It's all in Nathan's name. It's beautiful. And if we can turn it into a community event every year, so his friends can help too, it will be wonderful." She said that the family were finding comfort in knowing that Nathan was in heaven with his grandparents, who he loved dearly. They spoke with Calgary Herald about the foundation.
We still miss Nathan. And we're trying to cope and, you know, get this foundation off the ground and keep the goodness of life and hope alive. You know, we have our children. Keeping in mind that, you know, Nathan's spirit is still alive and he's going to guide us from here on in and with the help of us and do some good work in this world and show that we're ready to give back on a lifetime basis. An anonymous individual from the United States wanted to get involved and he was deeply affected by Nathan, and he's a very Christian faithful kind of guy.
He grew up, so he has two brothers himself, so he immediately relates. With the help of remarkable people, this foundation is able to come about, and it's, like I said, a private children's foundation, so it's not actually a foundation that where we'll go and raise money or do any fundraising, so it will just be gifting money, and that's the mission, is to, you know, follow Nathan's example of kindness and compassion and do good for others.
Nathan would be all over it because he led the way in life. He was always a very warm, outgoing individual.
As mentioned at the start of this episode, two things that Nathan loved were superheroes and hockey. And in February, his two loves would combine to raise money for the Nathan O'Brien Children's Foundation. The Calgary Flames alumni squad were facing Nathan's heroes at the Scotiabank Saddle Dome for a charity game. Nathan's heroes would be made up of the investigators who had worked tirelessly on the case, as well as MLAs and some members of Nathan's family. His father Rod said, "The hope is, from the foundation's perspective, that we get to carry on Nathan's spirit in something that he loved, and for us, it's giving back to the community on a larger scale. We can give back to the children's charities in the Calgary area." Over 15,000 tickets would be sold, and many in attendance dressed up in superhero costumes. It was a fitting tribute to Nathan. It was the first big event for the foundation, and Nathan's parents said that he would have been in awe. There were former NHL stars, such as Theo Fleury, Jamie McCoon, and Martin Galinas. The money raised would be going to support local children's charities, including the Children's Cottage Society, Brown Bagging for Calgary Kids, the Even Start Children's Foundation, and the Kids First Grassroots Development Foundation. Have you ever come across the concept of custom beauty? I know it sounds skeptical. It's like every time you scroll online, there's a new miracle product promising to fix your hair and skin woes. But let me tell you, PROS is the real deal when it comes to custom beauty. It's not just some marketing gimmick. Your personalized formula wouldn't even exist without your input. Each product on PROS is whipped up just for you, tailored to your specific needs, and they go deep into their consultations, delving into over 80 factors to really get a handle on your life and beauty goals. We're talking about everything from your hair and skin concerns to what you eat, how much you work out, and even how stressed you are. My friend Jen has been using Prose and raving about it non-stop. They even asked her about her zip code to suss out things like water hardness and UV index. When I hit the States later this year, Prose is going to be at the top of my shopping list. But until then, I'm living vicariously through Jen's luscious locks and glowing skin. Trust me, this stuff is the real deal. Prose is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/morbidology. That is prose.com/morbidology for your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formula, prose.com/morbidology.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On the 20th of May 2015, the preliminary trial began. The purpose was to determine if there was enough evidence against Douglas for him to stand trial on the 3 murders. Before it began, however, Judge Bob Wilkins imposed a publication ban on the evidence which would be presented. The judge would ultimately agree with Prosecutor Parker that there was enough evidence against Douglas for him to stand trial for the 3 murders. He also elevated the charges so that he would be standing trial on 3 counts of first-degree murder, instead of 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder. The trial was scheduled for 2017. With the prosecution and the defence preparing to fight their cases in trial, the Nathan O'Brien Superhero Sports Decathlon at Springbank Park was scheduled. His parents revealed that the anonymous donor of the $1 million was William Neisler, a US businessman who continued to work alongside the couple in benefiting needy children. There was also a dinner and silent auction scheduled, as well as a Saturday home run derby. All of the proceedings would be going towards charities of the family's choice. In December of that year, Douglas appeared in court where his trial was given a date. It was going to begin in January of 2017, and it was expected to last 5 weeks. Before it began, Nathan, Alvin, and Catherine's family issued a statement through the police, which read in part, "It has been 2.5 years since Nathan, Alvin, and Kathy were taken from us. Our pain has not lessened during this time. The next 5 weeks of this trial will be very difficult for us. We can only hope that at the end of this grueling time, we will find justice for Nathan, Alvin, and Kathy. We are grateful for the overwhelming support we have received from people in Calgary and across the country." The trial began on the 16th of January, and it was going to be the first time that the public had heard any details about the murder case, other than what was reported in the media. Since there had been a publication ban at the preliminary hearing, it wasn't yet known what kind of evidence investigators had uncovered, or what kind of motivation they were putting forward. During her opening statements, Crown Prosecutor Vicky Faulkner said that Douglas had been motivated by a petty grudge over a patent dispute that dated back years. It was a patent that Alvin had filed for a pump that Douglas did some work on. She said, "A pump that never made any real money. A pump that didn't make anyone famous." She said that when Douglas learned through internet searches that Alvin and Catherine were moving away from Calgary, he decided to act on his grudge. She said that evidence would show that he'd researched murder as well as torture and autopsies and how to kill somebody without any emotion. She revealed that after killing Nathan, Alvin and Catherine, Douglas then burned them in a barrel. Evidence would be presented that showed the DNA from the missing family were found on saw and meat hooks at the property, and bones and a tiny tooth were found in a large smouldering burn barrel. Prosecutor Faulkner also revealed that a mapping plane, which had flown over the property and took photographs, took a photograph which showed three bodies in the grass. Alvin and Catherine were lying face down in the grass, while Nathan was curled up beside them. Prosecutor Faulkner said that advertisements of the couple's real estate sale spurred the accused into action. She said this action took the form of obsessive and methodical planning. Planning which would lead to the violent death of Alvin, Catherine, and Nathan. The first witness of the trial to be called to testify was Jennifer, Nathan's mother. She said that on his last day alive, he was given the opportunity to either visit the zoo or visit his grandparents. He picked to visit his grandparents. She stated, he was just truly a kind, loving, happy, happy boy. She also spoke about the close relationship she had with her mother, Catherine, and her stepfather, Alvin, who had helped raise her, calling her mother her best friend. She said that after the real estate sale at the home, they ordered a Chinese and watched a movie together. Nathan then asked if he could sleep overnight at his grandparents' home. She revealed that the next day, when she went to pick Nathan up, she knew immediately that she was in the middle of a crime scene. She said that there was blood on the beds, walls, and the kitchen. She said to the jury, I immediately saw pools of blood and hand marks of blood on the wall. Alan Lickness, Alvin's son, who is married to Douglas's sister Patty, would testify next as a prosecution witness. It would be revealed that both Alan and Patty were instrumental in alerting investigators to Douglas as a potential suspect. He testified that Douglas and his father had worked together around 2006 to 2007. Alvin had hired Douglas to do some wiring for a pump that Alvin and Alan were developing. He said that the relationship between Douglas and his father disintegrated at the beginning of 2007, when Douglas became upset that he had been let go from the business when he stopped answering his mobile phone. Then by 2010, Alvin and Alan had both stopped talking to Douglas because they were fed up with his behaviour. It was Alan who had told investigators that Douglas had a long-standing grudge against his father, and then it was Patty who informed them that her brother drove a green truck, similar to the one that they were searching for in connection with the disappearance. Under cross-examination by Defence Ross, Alan said that Douglas had never threatened his father. He said, he's not confrontational at all. If anything, he's sneaky. Archie Garland, Douglas's father, would tell the courtroom that Douglas was allegedly angry over unpaid money. He said, Alvin didn't pay Dougie some money, and that didn't sit well. He told the jury he had told his son to forget about it, that it was just a bump in the road, but that anger still lingered. He said that garbage on the family's property was incinerated in a large burning barrel that wasn't visible from the family's home because it was behind a hedge. He said that when the burning barrel became too full, it'd be taken to the dump or was just left on the ground. Under cross-examination by Defence Ross, Archie described his son as a bit of a loner and said that he had never seen him show violence to anybody. His mother, Doreen Garland, painted her son in a very troubled light. She spoke about the mental breakdown he had suffered and stated, "He's my son. I love him. I think he's an unhappy man. He didn't discuss his problems with me." She said that when the news report about the disappearance came on the television, and she questioned whether Alvin and Catherine had taken Nathan away, Douglas replied, "I don't know. I don't want to talk about the Licknesses." She found this strange considering the fact one of the few things that Douglas ever got excited about was his grudge against Alvin. She revealed that on the morning of the 30th of June 2014, Douglas had left the home for his usual psychiatrist appointment. However, she later received a phone call from the psychiatrist, who said that Douglas had not shown up. The testimony from Douglas's parents was really quite poignant, and it must have broken their hearts to testify against their own son. The couple were both well into their 80s. The jury would next hear some of the forensic evidence which was uncovered during the investigation. Constable Derek Alexson from the Forensic Crime Scene Unit testified that despite the bloody crime scene, the investigators on the case were still holding out hope. They even considered that Nathan could be hiding somewhere within the home. Inside, he swabbed blood droplets, bloody smear marks, and bloody drag marks. There was blood in the bedrooms, the bedding, dumbbells, the garage, the kitchen, and carpets in the hallway. He stated, "I did note that there was a lot of blood down that south hallway leading into the bedroom. I noted that blood again as I exited. It appeared that there was almost drag marks through that blood as it went downstairs to the main floor of the house. Bloody drag marks led out the door to the attached garage, where it stopped in a pool of blood." He said that while searching the home, he found a dumbbell that was stuffed underneath the workbench. When he pulled it out, he realised that there was blood on it. He also testified that they had found a tooth laying in the back hallway. A photograph was displayed to the courtroom, which showed a pair of pink pyjama bottoms that were found lying beside a pull-out sofa in the basement. Jennifer would identify them as the pair of pyjamas that her son had been wearing that night. Constable Alexson then testified about some of the evidence found at Douglas's home. He said that 9 months after the initial search of the home, they returned and seized 6 barrels of ashes from a burn pit on the property, and spent the next several weeks sifting through the ashes. More testimony would be presented later in relation to this. Jurors would next hear testimony from a locksmith, Monte Solway, who testified that the lock on the family's side door had been tampered with. The keyhole was found to be at a 90 degrees angle from where it should have been. Evidence would show that 17 days before the disappearance, Douglas had been researching the Slage BE-365, which was the same type of lock on the Lickness's door. 2 drill marks were also visible, one which would have caused the door to unlock. Constable Brian Clark would then testify about the internet router at the Lickness's home. It was disabled at some point between 2:10 a.m. and 8:10 a.m. Routers sync with service providers every 6 hours, and the Lickness's router synced at 2:10 a.m. but then didn't sink 6 hours later. Sergeant Lynn Gallen would state during the trial the bloody footprints found at the Lickness's home matched the shape and size of a pair of shoes that were missing from a shoebox found inside Douglas's home. They were identified as a shoe size 13W, Dr. Scholl's Delta 2 runner. While investigators never recovered the shoes, they purchased the same pair at Walmart, and it matched the footprints found at the crime scene. Her testimony would be followed by Constable Darcy Williams, who told the jury that a cadaver dog had indicated human remains in several parts of Douglas's property, in 4 different areas, including near a wood chipper, a burn barrel, and at a pile of ashes. It was at the pile of ashes he gave the strongest indication he had found human remains. When investigators arrived at the scene, the burn barrel was still actively burning. Sergeant Troy Switzer would then take the jury through some items they had found in Douglas's home. They had found books on how to dispose of a dead body, 36 tubes of dental anaesthetic, adult diapers, women's wigs, and hard drives which were hidden in rafters. He said that they found a new black duffel bag in one of the outbuildings, which was surrounded by dirty clutter and boxes. He said that inside that duffel bag, they found 2 pairs of handcuffs, an 8-to-10-inch hunting knife, and a billy club. In the outbuilding, they also found 2 meat hooks, 2 small items which appeared to be burnt flesh, leather and cotton restraints, metal ankle restraints, and lock-picking equipment, as well as firearm parts and several daggers. There was also a pair of child-sized handcuffs, chloroform, a powder that causes blood to clot, and a chemical used to destroy DNA. They had also seized a saw, which had DNA from both Nathan and Alvin on it. He testified that in the burn pile, they found a pair of glasses, bits of bone, and a tooth. Teeth had also been found on the floor at the Lickness's home. The evidence certainly showed that a very brutal fight for life had taken place. In fact, when Douglas was arrested, he was covered in injuries. He had cuts and bruises on his lip, head, knee, and thumb. The jury would be shown photographs of his injuries. Lead forensic investigator Constable Ian Oxton took to the stand and fielded questions from the defence team, When asked by Defence Ross if any of Douglas's DNA had been found inside the Lipnesses' home, he replied no. He revealed that no DNA had been found on the child-sized handcuffs, nor had DNA been found on any weapons located in the property or the black duffel bag. Constable Oxton became emotional as he testified about sifting through the ashes that were collected from the burn pit. He spoke about collecting earrings, a bracelet, buttons, a piece of shackle, and more than 2 kilograms of biological material, including bones, and 17 fragments believed to be human teeth. They also found a charged circuit board, which was identified as being a keyless car starter for a Toyota Tundra, the same vehicle which the Lipnesses had owned. Some of the bones, as well as a tooth, would be identified as coming from a child. A small bloody handprint was also found at knee level on a closet door in the Lipnesses' home. DNA would indicate that the blood was a mix of Nathan and his grandmother Catherine. More DNA evidence would then be presented. Vivian Moorbutter, a forensic analyst, would reveal the blood found on the 45-pound dumbbell inside the Lipnesses' home would show DNA from both Alvin and Catherine. On a hacksaw at Douglas's home, DNA from Nathan and Alvin would be found, while DNA from Alvin and Catherine would be found on a light switch in an outbuilding. DNA from all three victims would be found on a pair of rubber boots in Douglas's home. DNA from Alvin would also be found on the boot that Douglas was wearing when he was arrested. They had also found RNase Away, which was a product used in labs to clean DNA off equipment. It was evident that Douglas had attempted to clean away any evidence, but had missed a fair amount. A digital forensic investigator, Constable Doug Cran, would reveal to the jury that in the months leading up to the murders, Douglas had Googled from very sinister terms. He had researched most painful torture and had files on dismembered bodies, autopsy tools, and sexual photographs of adults in diapers. He had searched for the Lipnesses' real estate seal, the phone numbers of Catherine and Alvin, as well as bone grinders, blood removal solutions, and human dissection. On the hard drive, investigators had found photographs of Catherine and documents relating to Alvin. There was a folder named Gore, which contained 87 photographs of dead or dismembered people, as well as 18 documents on killing or murder. He had also saved a book titled How to Kill Without Joy, the complete How to Kill book. After the grim evidence was presented, a neighbour of Douglas would testify. Brian Cambach would tell the courtroom that in the days after the family's disappearance, he noticed a glow from the greenhouse of Douglas's property and a large fire. He stated, "It would have been in the burning barrel area. It wasn't unusual, but this fire did appear to be a little larger and had black smoke coming from it." CCTV footage from a neighbour of the Lipnesses would capture Douglas's truck parking near the Lipness home in the early morning hours of the night they vanished. That same truck would then be seen leaving the area around an hour and a half later, with something large and white in the back, possibly a tarp. The most highly anticipated moment of the trial came when the aerial photograph allegedly showing the three bodies on Douglas's property was presented. The photograph was taken by chance by a company specialising in air surveys. Pilot Gagnon, the president of Peregrine Aerial Surveys, said that the photograph was taken at 9:23 a.m. on the 1st of July. The prosecution said that the photograph showed the three victims lying in the grass on Douglas's property. Two figures on the ground certainly did appear to be adults, face down on the ground. The third figure in the photograph, much smaller, was curled out alongside the two others. The two larger figures appeared to be wearing some kind of white underwear, possibly adult diapers, like the ones found in Douglas's property. The heartbreaking photographs literally brought the trial to a standstill, and one juror asked to take a break. When the plane passed over the following day, the three figures could not be seen, but smoke could be seen coming from the fire pit. During trial, it would be revealed that after Douglas had been released on bail, he had attempted to return to his family's property in the early morning hours. However, the property was still under surveillance. Douglas had purchased a flashlight and gloves from Walmart, and then attempted to get back onto the property. Constable Richard Massionette said that as they moved towards Douglas and shone their lights on him, he took off running into the tall grass of the field. He hid in the bushes, and the officers caught up with him and arrested him. After 4 weeks of testimony, the prosecution rested their case. The defense elected to call no witnesses. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Shane Parker said that they believed the jury should, and will, find Douglas guilty on all three counts of murder, based on the evidence they had presented and common sense. He said that the undercurrent of the case was one of domination, adding that Douglas never forgave and never forgot. He stewed. He said that Douglas had attacked the family and then brought them back to his farm to murder them. The prosecution didn't believe that the family were killed in their own home. Douglas wanted to take his time with the murders, and knew he could do that back at his own property. As for Nathan, he said, "You cannot leave a witness. Once Nathan witnessed the attack on Kathy in the front room, he had to be killed." Defence Ross ended by stating, "Mr. Garland did not cause the deaths of Alvin, Kathy and Nathan." He said that Douglas was innocent until the prosecution proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty, and said that doubt was the master of Douglas's fate. He stated, "There's no evidence, period, that places Douglas Garland in the house." He didn't once mention the plethora of DNA evidence which placed the deceased in Douglas's property, however, nor did he mention the photograph of their bodies on his property. It was now time for the jury to deliberate. They deliberated for 8.5 hours, before finding Douglas Garland guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder. The trial had revealed that the murder case was nothing short of horrific. Douglas had meat hooks, saws, shackles, leashes, handcuffs, restraints, and weapons hidden in the property that he shared with his elderly parents. On top of that, he had adult diapers, women's clothing, and wigs, as well as books on how to conduct autopsies and commit murder. There were even bits of charred flesh and teeth. The evidence truly was traumatizing to everybody involved. To know that Nathan, Alvin and Catherine had met such a gruesome end made the case all the more horrendous. While no intact bodies were found, there was a plethora of evidence that a crime had taken place, but also evidence that Douglas had been harboring such intense hatred for something so minor. The sentencing phase would follow. The family were able to provide emotional impact statements. Jennifer stated, 2.5 years removed from the tragedy, I still fight the darkness that threatens to take me down. It seems that pain is never ending. Something that I did not ask for, resulting in heartache that has not lessened since the murder." She said that she feels blessed when Nathan's friends come over to play, or she attends one of their hockey games, but said that it's tinged with sadness, because she will never get to see her own son grow up or score the winning goal. She stated, "I cry for my son Luke, who is thrust into traumatic loss and now grows up without his brother, Nathan, his best friend and his grandparents. Luke taught Nathan everything he knew and showed so much grace and compassion towards him. So much so, I remember thinking how grateful I was to have him as Nathan's big brother." Rod spoke about how Nathan's brothers are his best friends, and they always looked out for one another and loved playing together. He said, "Nathan's younger brother only got to know and experience Nathan for 21 months. He had only started being able to start playing around with his older brothers for 6 months, as he was just learning to walk and keep up. Nathan adored his little brother, and could not walk by him without kissing him or hugging his little brother. Now Nathan's little brother will never have a memory of his brother, except what we show him or tell him due to his young age." He said that he is constantly asked by his 2 other sons why Nathan had to go to heaven and who hurt him. He revealed that shortly before Nathan's death he had asked about heaven. He asked what heaven was like and whether you could fly in heaven. Rod said he told his son that in heaven, there is only joy, love, and happiness. Nathan replied that he would like to be there one day and welcome his parents into heaven. Rod informed his son that it wouldn't be that way. Instead, it would be them welcoming him to heaven. That he had to grow up, become a father, and live to be very old before he went to heaven. Rod said, "It makes me wonder why Nathan was asking about heaven, except that I now believe God had begun to reassure Nathan that he would be there to take care of him forever in paradise." Jeff, who is Catherine and Alvin's son, said that not a day goes by where he doesn't wake up and think about what had been taken from him. He said that he still often dreamed of his parents and felt the happiness he did when they were around. However, then reality sets in and he remembers that he will never see his parents again. He stated, "The home where I grew up is now replaced with blackness and grief. Memories of where I used to play and sleep are now covered in blood. A sanctuary of happiness and safety is something that Doug also took with him along with the three people I love." Douglas Garland would be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 75 years. As the verdict was read aloud, applause erupted in the courtroom. Douglas showed no semblance of emotion. He had not shown a shred of remorse since the very beginning. From the courtroom, Douglas was transferred to the Calgary Remand Center. Within hours, he was attacked by other inmates, causing a concussion. Four inmates would be charged with the attack. Then the following month, Douglas would be attacked by inmates again in the Edmonton Institution, where he had been transferred to from the Calgary Remand Center.
Nathan had started asking me at nighttime what heaven was like, which is kind of a strange question coming from a five-year-old, and say, well, you can fly around in heaven like a superhero, because Nathan loved superheroes. There's no night times. You can play all the time. He goes, well, I'm going to welcome you into heaven, Dad.
When it was first uncovered that Nathan O'Brien, Alvin Lickness, and Catherine Lickness were missing, it appeared as though this was a horrific and daring random kidnapping by person or persons unknown. Many speculated that somebody had come along to the real estate sale and decided then and there to return later for nefarious purposes. As time and the investigation progressed, however, people began to realize that this really wasn't the case. Douglas Garland had been harboring a grudge for years, and over those years he had accumulated more and more sinister items, turning his own home into a literal house of horrors, before finally unleashing his violence on an unsuspecting and innocent family. On the night that his grim plans materialized, it just so tragically happened that Nathan was at his grandparents' home, and Douglas incorporated the young boy into his already meticulous plan. Well, folks, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Bobby and Jennifer. The support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful. It helps to defray the costs of filing freedom of information requests, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much, much more. In return for your support up on Patreon, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, as well as a handwritten thank you note, ad-free and early release episodes behind the scenes, and much more. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to those who have left kind reviews up on Apple Podcasts recently. Ratings and reviews really are such an easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely love reading. I always take the constructive criticism on board in a bid to try and improve Morbidology for my lovely listeners. Also, friendly reminder that it's CrimeCon in London this weekend. I'm going to be there all weekend, and I hope to see some of you there. There's even a true crime quiz on the Saturday night that anybody can get involved in, and lots of other fun stuff as well. If you're going alone, feel free to hit me up on social media and I'll meet you there. There's even day tickets and regular tickets left, so if you want to come and hang out, use the code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, Reddit on Wiki. Till next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Oh my god, John, were you up on Wikipedia all night?
John, are you okay? You're shaking.
You guys, you will not believe what I just read on Wiki. Welcome to Reddit on Wiki, the poorly researched, semi-funny podcast on random stuff we find on the internet.
Who are you talking to?
And why are you shaking so much?
Subscribe to Reddit on Wiki on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Sean, I'm scared.
Me too, buddy. Me too.
Have you ever come across the concept of custom beauty? I know it sounds skeptical. It's like every time you scroll online, there's a new miracle product promising to fix your hair and skin woes. But let me tell you, pros is the real deal when it comes to custom beauty. It's not just some marketing gimmick. Your personalized formula wouldn't even exist without your input. Each product on Pros is whipped up just for you, tailored to your specific needs, and they go deep into their consultations, delving into over 80 factors to really get a handle on your life and beauty goals. We're talking about everything from your hair and skin concerns to what you eat, how much you work out, and even how stressed you are. My friend Jen has been using Pros and raving about it non-stop. They even asked her about her zip code to suss out things like water hardness and UV index. When I hit the States later this year, Pros is going to be at the top of my shopping list. But until then, I'm living vicariously through Jen's luscious locks and glowing skin. Trust me, this stuff is the real deal. Pros is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/morbidology. That is PROSE.com/morbidology for your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formula, pros.com/morbidology.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do. And start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.